We're talking with Grant Cameron, co-author of the new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants, and the whole concept of disinformation, that our government would put out phony stories about UFOs and crashed saucers might seem ridiculous to the uninitiated, but Grant Cameron thinks there's plenty of evidence that that's exactly what happened. We'll be going down a laundry list of some of the other names and figures who are mentioned prominently in his book, and then open up the phone lines with your questions here on Coast to Coast AM. Grant Cameron, let's cover some ground here. Speak to me in general about the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA. It was created in the 70s there, and it changed a lot of things. I remember, you know, you look back at the requests that researchers like yourself had made prior to its existence. You ask the FBI or CIA for their UFO documents, and they say we don't have any. Then FOIA becomes the law of the land, and they're forced to release thousands of pages of information. Do you think that the stuff they were forced to release is real, or it's bogus and altered?
It's real. All the other documents are phony, which we can get into in a minute, but all the FOIA stuff is real. And I think about half of all the UFO documents that we have in our possession all came out during the Carter administration. And that's because Carter had forced it. He basically said, we're going to follow the law. We're going to do this. He wanted those as well, so he was trying to flesh it out. And Kit Green, who was a former CIA analyst at the CIA, who was responsible for handing out the CIA UFO files, talked about this sort of like sort of a war inside the CIA to try to avoid this FOIA. And he talks about this girl who was in charge who came and came into his office crying, and how he had some of his private UFO material were there, and this sort of got tied up in the FOIA, and he was sort of reprimanded, like, why did you bring this stuff into work? Get this stuff out of here. And he talked about this sort of like a real panic mode. But I think they've sort of learned to walk around it. For example, if you file an FOIA with the CIA, they'll always play the, you're going to pay for it. You know, how much are you willing to pay? And it's going to take, you know, X number of hours at, you know, piles of money. And vast majority of people just walk away from it. Now, I've gotten lucky a couple of times. I got the, when I filed FOIA with the Clinton administration, because the rumor was that Clinton was very interested. And I managed to get, by following Bruce McAbee, who had filed an FOIA, I filed the same FOIA, and I got twice as much as he did. I got 1,000 pages, and this detailed the Rockefeller Initiative from the Clinton administration, where Rockefeller went to the Clintons and were trying to force. And these are, like, really interesting documents. It's not like, you know, stuff that just citing reports and stuff. This is actual, you know, memos going back and forth between people in the White House and Rockefeller's people, and very interesting stuff. The thing is, when I tried to redo it, because the Clintons went out of office, and then 5 years after the Clintons leave, you can file FOIA. So I filed 100 FOIAs, knowing who all the people in the administration were. And so the Clinton library started to release the stuff. And then it went after these 1,000 pages that I'd gotten originally from the Office of the Science Advisor, and I cannot find them. I've gone to the National Archives, and they have basically disappeared. And I've sent them the actual inventory. Here's the documents. Here's the dates. Here's the inventory. Here's the letters I got. Nowhere to be found. So they've sort of learned to walk around the FOIA stuff. And the stuff you get out of there really is not very significant. The real stuff, as most people sort of assume, has been moved into the black world, into off-government stuff. That the stuff that they have, there's always a thing, does the president even know what's going on? There's no doubt that vast majority of people in government have no idea what's going on, that you have to find out. So I've sort of left the FOIA, even though I file, and have gone to try to find out who's actually got it. It's not the government, it's somebody else, and going after those type of documents. And that's where you get into the thing about the leaked documents, which a lot of people will say are hoaxed. And I firmly believe that all the documents that have been leaked are all phony, but they're all very, very important. And when there you go back, you look at a guy that you knew, that I knew, that was Bill Moore, who in the 1980s, nobody really knows who he is anymore, but in the 1980s was probably one of the most prominent researchers with Stanton Friedman in the UFO community. And in 1989, he gave a speech in Las Vegas. It was the last speech he gave. And this is the one where he talked about one document that he knew was phony, that he'd handed off to a guy by the name of Paul Benowitz. And at that point, the place just erupted. people were throwing stuff at him, people were yelling, and nobody really listened to his speech. But in his speech, he basically talked about the fact that he'd been contacted by high-level officials inside the government, and he said something very significant. I'll just read one chapter, one small paragraph to you that explains exactly what's happened. And what Bill Moore says, he talks about the fact that after he released the Roswell book, when Roswell became famous, it was because Bill Moore in 1980 had released this book called The Roswell Incident, and Stanton Friedman helped him break this thing. He had released this book, and about 9 days after he went on his book tour, and this book, I think, sold a million copies or whatever, it made Roswell famous, he was contacted by a guy who called himself the Falcon. He was contacted twice. The first time, Bill Moore didn't take the phone call. The second time, he did take the phone call, and he got hooked because the guy said, you're the only guy who knows what you're talking about in ufology, and Bill Moore had an ego. Bill Moore fell for it, and he describes this guy, and this is very important, that he says in this speech in 1989, the last speech he gave, he said, I was approached by a well-placed individual within the intelligence community who claimed that he to be directly contacted with high-level project dealing with UFOs. This individual told me that he spoke for a small group of similar individuals who were uncomfortable with the government's continuing cover-up of the truth and indicated that he and this group would like to help me with my research into the subject and give an in the expectation that I might be able to help them find a way to change the prevailing policy and get the facts to the public. This is important, to get the facts to the public without breaking any laws in the process. And that's the whole key. All the UFO documents that have been leaked have to be phony. The MJ-12 document, is, I think, is basically phony because we now believe there was a live alien. There wasn't four dead aliens like the document claims. There was a live alien. But the whole idea is you can't break the law. And if you release a classified document, you're going to jail. They're going to get you. And the prime example of that was last year, they went after Obama and the White House because these leaks came out about sabotaging the computers in Iran, the nuclear computers, and about the drones. And they were going after the White House. They were going after Obama for release of classified material. Whether you're the president or whether you're just a researcher in UFOs in the field, if you release classified material, you are going to jail. So what the Falcon, this Falcon guy who is headed this group of people who were talking to Bill Moore, said, we are going to help you, but we can't break the law. And he said, part of what you're going to get is true. Part of what you're going to get is not true. You're going to have to sort out what's true and what's not. And so that's the same principle. You're releasing the material in a flood of disinformation because that's the way they have to do it. If you release classified material, you're going to jail. Prime example, again, you come to the Chase Brannon story, which just happened last year. The White House puts out a statement and says UFOs are not, and it's the first time the White House has actually put out a statement. It's not national security, and there's no evidence of extraterrestrials on the Earth. Suddenly, this Chase Brannon guy, 40 years with the CIA, and for 10 years was second most powerful spokesman inside the CIA, who could speak on behalf of the CIA because he's working on this as a liaison to Hollywood. This highly powerful guy comes out and says, oh, by the way, I was at Langley, and I saw this box, and it was had a Roswell on the side, and I looked in the box. I can't tell you what was in the box, but I can confirm to you that what was in the box confirmed to me absolutely that Roswell happened and that there were bodies. And the whole thing that I concluded from that whole thing, this guy would not come out. You cannot come out if you're the CIA, because they basically their job is to provide intelligence for the president. You're not going to have some guy come out from the CIA and throw them under the Roswell bus and get away with it. If it's classified material, he's going to jail. And that's why he tells a story that what's in the box, I can't tell you what was in the box. You can do whatever you want. I can't tell you. Because if he identifies a certain photograph, a certain document that's classified material, and he breaks the law. So that's how they do it. They make up this story, I saw a box, and this, and he sort of gets the idea across that Roswell's for real. The 65th anniversary of the Roswell crash, happy birthday, here it is, another leak. And the idea that this guy could come out and do this. For example, if he were to say, I saw a box on the side, it had Bin Laden. And I looked inside, and I can confirm to you that I saw that Bin Laden had been killed at Tora Bora in 2000, the story would have been everywhere. The president would have been drawn up. The White House would have been answering questions. And because it was a UFO thing, everybody just looked at it, figured, ah, it's just another UFO story, and went on and did something else. It was a high-level guy putting this out. And Bill Moore had all these high-level people, and some of them, from what we've indicated, what we sort of know now, some of them were former CIA directors. Robert Gates, Helms, Richard Helms. He had some very high-level people who were feeding him this material. But it was all, again, it was phony documents that had real material. And a lot of people said, well, Bill Moore hoaxed it. It was very obvious that Bill Moore didn't hoax it, because Bill Moore left the field in 1989, and anybody who was there at the time knows that in 1990, what were called the new MJ-12 documents started to be leaked. And they, Bob Wood and Ryan Wood, two father, son, were the people that sort of gathered these documents together. I asked them at one point, I said, how many pages are we dealing with here? And they said, over 4,000. 4,000 pages of leaked documents. And they were very sophisticated, because Bob Wood was a high-level guy. He was an engineer with Douglas Aircraft. He was a smart guy, and he was sort of buying into these documents. He was researching them. The idea that you'd have 4,000 documents leaked into the UFO community, this is not Bill Moore. It's not Richard Doty. This is an agency. And the question is, why are they leaking 4,000 pages of documents? They're trying to tell a story. But the documents are all phony. They have to be phony, because you can't release classified information. That's how they're getting the story out.
So releasing the story, but muddying the waters, sort of what they did with Falcon and Condor, these guys that showed up on television in 1988, I think. You mentioned that in the book as well.
Yeah, and people will say, like, that's another thing that happened exactly the same time as Lazar. It was October of 1988. Lazar does the interviews and goes up about 6 weeks later up onto the test site. 6 weeks before, you have this UFO cover-up live show that took place. Now, in the book, I only briefly mention it, but it's a way bigger story. If you take a look at that documentary, and at the time, it was really hyped. In that documentary, you have, for example, they show a flowchart, and it shows on the flowchart, it shows Area 51. This is September of 1988. So this is before you did the story and exposed Area 51. It's on that flowchart. It says Area 51 is part of the UFO thing. It shows the DIA remote viewing program is on that flowchart. That does not become declassified till 1995. It's on that flowchart. They have sort of some pictures of aliens, like drawings of aliens, that when they blew them up and freeze framed the video, there was markings on the bottom which showed that these schematic drawings of aliens had come from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And then there was some that from satellites that were the satellites that supposedly picked up the fast walkers. The satellites were picking up UFOs coming in, and there's freeze frames that show the number of that satellite. So there's all these type of things, and then you take a look at the whole other part, that when I did the research, a story I had back in the 1980s that I never made public until this book came out was the fact that at one point, one of the researchers that broke the Walker story was Bill Steinman, and I knew Bill Steinman very well, and Bill Steinman and Bill Moore were very close friends. They both lived in Los Angeles, and at one point they were chasing a guy in Albuquerque, who had supposedly come from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, was running the program. He had died. Bill Steinman's interviewing his wife, and his wife is saying, Henry Kissinger is the boss. You should be talking to Henry Kissinger. He's the guy that came to my husband. So he's doing this interview, and Bill Moore phones him up the next day, and Bill Moore says, what were you talking to Mrs. Wang for? And Steinman says, well, how do you know I was talking to Mrs. Wang? And he says, I know you were talking, and he starts telling Steinman what was in the conversation. And he said, well, how do you know what we said? It's almost like you were listening in on the phone conversation. And Bill says, okay, come to my place tomorrow, and I'll explain it to you. So Bill goes over to Bill Moore's house, and Bill says, well, I got to tell you, when I was going to university, I was recruited by the CIA. And the CIA came to me, and I did a couple papers for them. I did a little bit of research for them. And then I went on, became a school teacher, and did all the stuff he did. But when I got into UFOs, I reacquainted myself with my contacts inside the CIA. And so here you have a situation where Bill Moore is confirming that he has these contacts, and that's how he got all these high-level contacts. He's basically CIA. And after he left the field, the guy that he brought in, when the MJ-12 documents came out, they didn't get Stanton Friedman. Stanton Friedman was the best researcher in the field. He helped them work on it. But instead of getting Stanton Friedman to help with all this material that the Falcon was leaking, piles and piles, and these birds were giving him all this material, he picks up Jamie Chandra. And Jamie Chandra was the guy that got the MJ-12 documents in the mailbox. So everybody said, well, this is phony, because Jamie Chandra is not even a UFO researcher. Why would they give the documents? Why didn't they mail them to Moore? This is all a setup. It's all Moore. And Moore releases it in an interview he did after he left. He said, well, Chandra was CIA. He'd worked for the CIA. So, of course, here you have Moore CIA, Chandra CIA. You have this UFO cover-up live show that took place just before Lazar goes up, and it was very hyped. And you have Gray Advertising, the producers from Gray Advertising, which Linda Howe will say numerous times, it's a CIA front company. And if you look on the internet, it's listed as one of the 500 CIA front companies. You have all this stuff was scripted. Everybody had to read from a script. You could not vary from the script. And Bob Emenegger didn't know who wrote the script. You had Alan Sandler, who had intelligence connections. You had a meeting that I document in the book. The day after that UFO cover-up live show took place, there was a meeting in the office of the counterintelligence director at the CIA. And Ronald Pendolfi was there, who is the head of the weird desk that runs the UFO files. Kit Green, that had the files before him, was in the meeting. Hennessy, who was there, who was a head of stealth technology, all the security for stealth technology was there. And the guy who was in charge of the Roswell report for President Clinton. These people were all in the office, and they're talking about this UFO cover-up live show the night before and talking about Richard Doty. Well, how did they know Richard Doty was there? This was all CIA. That show was entirely CIA. It was run by the CIA. The Falcon, who Bill Moore said was a high-level CIA guy, Bill Moore confirmed to me, because I got the story, he was sitting in the audience. There was only a couple of people in the audience because it was a live show, and there was a studio audience. It was just a couple of people. So here you have this top-level CIA guy is watching this thing being filmed. They've got a link into the Soviet Union. They have just totally CIA, and they're releasing material that was classified and would be classified till 1995. And the CIA has a meeting the next day, and they're talking about Richard Doty and saying, oh, well, the guy, he's a phony type thing. And then Kit Green says, well, he passed the lie detector test. So here you have a meeting taking place about an event the night before. And it just simply shows that it was controlled. They're having a meeting to see how it had gone, how did this thing come across. And it just sort of died away as another phony thing with bad music. And when you take a look at the thing and you go into real detail and start looking at who the producer was, who was running it, all this sort of stuff, it just comes across that it was a setup to get the material out. And because of the bad music and they had the alien eating ice cream, strawberry ice cream, everybody just sort of threw it out, and the story got out, and the actual story died, but the material got out.
We got to go to a break in about 30 or 40 seconds. Very quickly, Annie Jacobson came out with a best-selling book a year ago about Area 51, a great book about the history of legitimate national security programs out there. But in the end, she drops a bombshell about flying saucers being built by Joseph Stalin, based on Nazi technology, flown by concentration camp survivors. It threw the whole thing into a big question mark. Well, the music is telling us we need to go to a break, but we'll pick that up on the other side and then take questions from the audience. Much more to come here with Grant Cameron on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Grant Cameron. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions right after this on Coast to Coast AM. So, Grant, before the break, I'm asking you about Andy Jacobson's book. It's a bombshell at the end of the book. Great book about Area 51. But then she says at the end, she's got a source who says, yes, there were saucers at Area 51, but they weren't aliens. They were from the USSR, sent by Stalin, built by Nazis, and the aliens who were flying them were actually surgically altered concentration camp survivors operated on by Joseph Mengele. Pretty wild stuff. What do you make of it?
Of course, it's totally stupid. It's like the crash test dummies being dropped, you know, 5 years after Roswell explaining the bodies. It comes down to me like when you have skeptics that come on Larry King or any show, it doesn't really matter what they say. It's like, just say something, put out some stupid explanation, and it's hard to fight off. Annie Jacobson was sort of like a sitting duck. She had talked to the Roadrunners and gotten all that and did some research. But when it came to UFOs, it's what you said at the beginning of the show, this is a steep learning curve. And you've run up against it when people want to come and do an Area 51 thing, and I've run up against when people want to do the presidential thing, and you get a phone call from some 25-year-old girl who's the chief researcher and hasn't read a UFO book, and it's like, tell them whatever you want. They're going to do it, and it's like, unless you have a background in this thing, you are easy to set up, and because it's a very steep learning curve, and you got a lot to learn to weed out the wheat from the chaff.
Well, we agree on that. East of the Rockies, Jeff in Cleveland. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. George, you guys are reporting, in fact, you did it tonight, on these giant triangles that are out there. And I'm wondering if Grant has ever done any investigation on them and if there's some kind of a cover-up, because it would seem to me that as big as they are and as frequent as they keep being mentioned, that network news ought to be picking up on them, and they're obviously not. And I'll take my answer up here.
I think it's a good point, and you'd think that people would see them taking off and landing in bases as big as they are. What's your take on that?
Well, I agree that probably a lot of this is American military technology, but I mean, as with Area 51, nobody knew anything until you guys broke it. I mean, they could fly it out of there behind mountains where they're up into the, you know, high atmosphere before they ever get over populated areas, or they could be flying it from some island in the middle of the Pacific or something like that. They have unlimited amounts of money, but an interesting story is, I got involved with UFOs back in 1975, just north of the Minuteman III missile silos that were aimed at Russia. This is 2 weeks after the end of the Vietnam War, and I had four dramatic sightings. And one of them, we had some objects on the ground. We were flashing lights at them, and suddenly this thing appeared in the sky, came around, was a giant triangle. It sat right on top of the car. It was the most terrifying moment of my life. This happened in April of 1976 in Canada. So the triangles have been around for an awful long time, but I would agree that a lot of the stuff that's flying around now is basically American technology, which is why I really don't do sightings, because when it comes to sightings, the most you're ever going to get with sightings is an unknown. Whether it's sightings or whether it's a photograph, the best you're going to get is an unknown. And the prime example of that is the NARCAP, when they had the airplane thing with at O'Hare. They had the UFO over there. NARCAP, which is a big UFO scientific group, put together the best people in the UFO community to look at what this thing was. They put out a 152-page report, spent 9 months working on this thing, and they basically came to the conclusion, unknown. You really cannot determine anything from sightings. And so I've sort of moved into the area of consciousness, that I say that unless you get inside the craft or talk to the people that are flying it, we aren't going anywhere in ufology. It's game over. There's nothing more you can learn about sightings, because now it's even worse, because you can't tell whether it's high-tech American stuff, whether it's flying saucers. You can't determine anything by what's flying around in the sky. The only thing you can do is you've got to get inside the craft, or you've got to talk to the people in there, or you've got to get a legitimate government piece of hardware, document, whistleblower, the government coming out. Otherwise, sightings really don't get us anywhere.
Yeah, it's a tough nut to crack. Some friends of mine here in Las Vegas, NIDS organization, doesn't exist anymore, did a study of triangles, and I think they concluded that a lot of them look like they might be ours, but some of them seem to behave in ways that suggest they belong to somebody else. I think some researchers have guessed that maybe these giant platforms are up there all the time, and they're involved in sort of sucking up information, emails, computer records, things of that sort, some part of a surveillance program. But until somebody comes forward and spills the beans, we're just not going to know. West of the Rockies, Jason in Washington. Hi, Jason.
Grant, what's the story of Colonel Weinbrenner's deathbed note? Can you tell the audience that?
It wasn't a deathbed note. We got this. I got an email from a guy in San Antonio, Texas. He was asking me for Bob Emenegger's email, so I gave him email, phone number, and he contacted Bob. And then Bob came to me and said, "Oh, this guy, his wife had been the what do you call it? She wasn't a nurse. She was sort of an attendant at Weinbrenner's." Sort of like an old folks home where he died. And what the husband would do is the husband would Google search the various clients. And these were all like high-ranking colonels, generals at this place in San Antonio where all the high-ranking officials would get apartments. And then you go from the apartment to sort of a care place. And so he had Google searched Weinbrenner's background for his wife so that she would have something to talk to the patients about, and had discovered this story that it was on my website about Bob Emenegger going to Weinbrenner's office during the making of this documentary. And that's when he said to Weinbrenner, he walked up to his desk and he said, "Tell me about the landing of the alien spacecraft at Holloman Air Force Base." And Weinbrenner started to draw a MiG-25 on the board and started ranting and raving about weather alterations and stuff. And Emenegger was saying, "Well, you know, maybe he didn't hear my question. Like, well, what's going on here?" And then he hands him the book, this famous story where Weinbrenner hands him the book, J. Allen Hynek book, and opens the front cover while he's ranting about MiGs and, you know, alterations. And it has "To my friend, General Weinbrenner, J. Allen Hynek." And then Emenegger got the idea that Weinbrenner thought the office was bugged, and he was confirming, "Yes, this is for real, but I can't talk to you about this." And anyway, so he had picked up this story. The husband had picked up this story and had told it to his wife. So his wife, wanting to talk to Weinbrenner about something, says, "Well, I understand you were involved in UFOs." And at first Weinbrenner said, "No, it was nothing. I wasn't involved," and stuff. And then he gave the wife a Star Wars passport. And this was a Star Wars passport that was being sold somewhere, and said, "Give this to your husband." And then it was at the end, when near his death, he said to the caregiver, the wife, he said, "I just wanted to let you know that we had 5 aliens in Utah." And that was all he said. He didn't say at an underground base, they were dead, they were alive. And this was a story that the husband had got from the wife, from Weinbrenner. And he was trying to get this to Bob Emenegger. So we went down there and we tried to interview the wife, but she was from El Salvador or something. And they had divorced since the incident. And we just couldn't understand her. I mean, she was just, I talked to her on the phone and we just could not communicate with her. But this was basically the story that Weinbrenner had said after denying UFOs for so long. And he was head of FTD. He was the head of the foreign technology at Wright-Patterson. He was a guy that should have known about UFOs and basically told her, "We had 5 aliens in Utah."
Wow. Thanks for the call, Jason. Going to go to our wild card line, Dawson in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Dawson.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
I just want to throw this out there about possibly when MJ-12 went rogue and quit reporting to the president, because, you know, we hear about him during Truman. And possibly an Eisenhower, some of the same people would have carried over in that administration. And then about the time that we lost JFK, you know, Truman didn't know about the atomic bomb until they made him president. They kept that from him. And I'm really wondering if maybe Kennedy had kept it from LBJ. And about the time that we lose Kennedy, maybe the guys that would have been the current MJ-12 people during that administration, maybe they just decided at that time they wanted to quit reporting to the president and take it underground and keep it to themselves. Because we hear the Nixon story with Jackie Gleason, but really after LBJ, it seems like it just drops off the map for presidents talking about it.
Good point, Dawson. You're talking to the right guy. I don't think anybody has done more work on which presidents know about UFOs than Grant. What do you think, Grant?
I've gone back and forth. I can tell both sides of the story. I can tell you, give you a lecture that says the president doesn't know. I can give you a lecture that says the president does know. I tend to think the president does know, and that this is plausible deniability, that constitutionally he has to know. If your president is not running the country, if there is a rogue group of people running the country, you guys are in a lot of trouble down there. And one example I can give you is Obama goes last year to Roswell. Before the election, Roswell is always like a, New Mexico is a swing state, and he makes this famous statement where when you go to Roswell, you got to make a UFO joke. So yeah. His UFO joke that opened his speech was, the question that's asked to me most by 9 and 10-year-old children, boys, is, what really happened at Roswell? What is the truth? And Obama says, I tell these little boys, if I told you the truth, I'd have to kill you. And then, of course, the crowd laughs, and this is his joke, and there's a pause in the speech, and then Obama says, we'll keep our secrets on Roswell. And so that indicated to me that here's a Democrat, left-wing Democrat. It's always been rumored that the Republicans know, because they're more pro-military, that guys like Carter, Clinton, Obama, these people would be out of the loop. I still think that he has to know that he's in charge of all the intelligence, and that a lot of this stuff, that there's a secret government behind the government and all this sort of stuff, is just something to divert attention away from the president. There's so much money, there's so much technology. If they're flying stuff at Area 51, Clinton sent guys to Area 51. He even talks about it in a speech in 2005 in Hong Kong. He's asked by the guy who's running this thing for this big investment company. He says, because I'm running this thing, I can ask you this question. And he says to Clinton, he says, what about... do the presidents pass secrets from one president to another? For example, where is Jimmy Hoffa's body buried, or what really happened at Roswell? And Clinton starts talking about Roswell, that he asked for the records, and he basically says, you know, that I'm probably not the first president they kept in the dark, or that bureaucrats have tried to wait out. But still, he said that everybody in his administration believed that Roswell wasn't real, but that Area 51, he didn't mention the base, but he said a base in Nevada, that there was an alien there and a spacecraft underground, and I sent someone there. So Clinton was very interested, and I think a guy like that is going to get the answer in terms of the basis, the basic parts of it, maybe not the details, but he has to have oversight. I can't see how it would work, all the amount of research going on, is say at Area 51 and advanced technology, he has to know. And let me give you one last example, and go to the next call, is that if you go to the presidential libraries, you will find nothing on UFOs, but you will also find absolutely not a single file on remote viewing. And I talked to Hal Puthoff, and Hal assured me they were briefed. And Jimmy Carter, in his diary, actually talks about being briefed on remote viewing. And he said it was one of the most fascinating things he'd seen in his president. It was unexplainable. If you go to the day when he said he was briefed, you will not find it in the presidential record. So because there is no records, does not mean the president is briefed. There's nothing on remote viewing. There's nothing on UFOs. I think the president has to know constitutionally. He has to be in charge of the whole operation, because all the intelligence people report to him, all the military report to him, the executive branch or the government itself, he's the chief executive officer. It doesn't matter where the people who are controlling it are, they still report to him. And people are very patriotic in the United States. There would be defections. If this thing was being run out of it, you would have people in the government defect. And I think they're following the rules because there's no defections. And because Dr. Eric Walker, one of the things he told us is he got very angry at one point in one of the interviews. He said, listen, why should we change the rules just to satisfy your curiosity? And he said this out of the blue, which gave me the indication. He said, why should we change the rules? There are rules that people are following. And when Bill Moore tried to help me, he sent Kit Green, who was a guy who Bill Moore said was the guy who would brief the president, that would answer questions on UFOs for the president. He went in to see Walker. Walker basically threw this guy out of the office. And Walker said, the president didn't say I have to talk to you. I'm not talking about this, and basically threw Kit Green out of the room. So again, there you have an indication that the president is in charge and there are rules, and that people inside the government are basically following the rules. Anybody who works for government, I work for government, I know that there is like paperwork and rules galore, that it's very rare to have something off the record.
Try to get one more quick call in. Danny in Kentucky and our first time caller, you got to make the question quick and the answer's got to be quick too. We okay, got about a minute.
There you go. I appreciate you taking my call. I know kind of what Grant's going through. I had a ship that landed on my farm and I went to it and there were aliens inside. But I got a lot to talk about. You got my phone number there on your caller ID. Have Grant call me back. I got a lot of information where I examined the ship. I know all about the people. They can't speak a word. There's a lot that I know that nobody else does know.
Okay, well, I got the perfect person to follow up. If you get the number, we'll follow up on it.
I'll ask Gina to get that number for us. Danny, thanks for calling us. Grant, so the book comes out tomorrow.
Yep.
And people can get it how?
There'll be a link on my site, which is presidentialufo.com. There'll be a link on Richard Dolan's site, and they can get it through Amazon.com. And they can also, I think it's available also in Europe and Great Britain, and basically through Amazon or through our website. So there'll be links all over the place.
Well, I congratulate you. It's a tremendous piece of work. And I think, you know, I think knowing you a little bit, it's not done. It's never going to be finished because there's always going to be other leads to follow. In fact, I've got a couple for you in particular about Robert Sarbacher, some personal information that I'll share with you that gives you, I think, shares some new light, but we'll do that off the air. And I really appreciate you being here.
Beautiful. And I appreciate your taking the time and lending your credibility to our book.
Well, it's, you know, it's a convoluted story, and I think it's made convoluted on purpose, as you point out in the book. So it's hard for people to follow it. So you got to be dedicated to, you know, a reader out there or a listener to this program has to be dedicated to follow up on it. And I hope people will check out your book.
Beautiful. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Grant Cameron is the co-author of UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants, along with Scott Crane. Check out that book. Want to say thanks also to Dr. Artie Clark, to Richard Dolan and John Lear, and to David, Gina, Tim Banal, Lex, and Dan, all my colleagues there at Premier. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next month. Good night, everyone.